proposed responses to climate change range from the simple and easy to the complex and far-reaching. As these efforts get underway, it's important to go in with our eyes open to avoid doing harm in our quest to do good. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, produced with USAID's Office of Conflict Management and Mitigation, we interview experts about backdraft, the unintended peace and conflict consequences of climate change responses. I'm Sean Peoples. Today I'm speaking with Simon Nicholson, professor at American University, about climate engineering and its environmental, political, and social implications. Simon, thank you for joining me today. I wanted to jump right in and ask you about the state of the climate engineering conversation. You know, specifically, how is the idea of unintended consequences or backdraft, as we've been discussing in this podcast, apply in that climate engineering conversation?
But when it comes to unintended consequences, one thing that we should say is that the entire climate engineering conversation is in some ways an unintended consequence of our not doing enough via the other options that we have at our disposal for tackling climate change. Very few people, I can't think of anybody, really wants to be talking about climate engineering. There are too many just risks that we already can conceive of, let alone the currently unknown risks, that folks are not particularly excited about trying to embark down this path, right? But the reason that you've got a growing number of scientists who are paying attention to the space and a growing number of policymakers saying, well, we may need to consider climate engineering technologies is because the situation by any number of measures is getting pretty desperate. Out of the Paris Agreement, of course, we have this more ambitious target now of no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. But if you just try and do the math on that and think about what it would mean to stay beneath 1.5 degrees of warming through traditional mitigation measures, that is energy transformation, land use change, trying to augment sinks, we've got about a decade or so, maybe a little longer, depending on who you're talking to completely wean the global energy economy off fossil fuels. And at the moment, there's little political appetite for that. Right? This is just the numbers based on the amount of carbon it would take to push us beyond that 1.5 degree threshold. And so, if the world community is serious about no more than 1.5 or allowing overshoot, that is going beyond 1.5 and then doing everything possible to bring the world back to 1.5 degrees of warming, then carbon dioxide removal technologies are on the table. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has forced, in some ways, carbon dioxide removal into the conversation by putting these sorts of technologies into the models. Solar radiation management is a different egg. Now, carbon dioxide removal is, with the current technologies that have been considered, pretty slow acting. That is on the order of decades or centuries to see measurable impact in greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. Quite expensive. For direct air capture, we can do it, but it's something like $150 to $200 a ton of captured carbon at the moment. And there are kind of lots of potential risks and challenges around land use and so forth that make it politically sticky. Yeah. Now, with solar radiation management, at least stratospheric aerosol injection and potentially marine cloud brightening, these would be extraordinarily fast acting in terms of their ability to bring down average temperatures, relatively cheap, right? And we'll have to kind of flesh out what I mean by cheap, because it's not kind of clear on its face that it's as cheap as some people make out. But back of the envelope calculations suggest just for a couple of billion dollars a year, you could put enough sulfur into the upper atmosphere to have a dramatic cooling effect. Yeah. And, you know, clearly politically unpalatable at the moment, but if the international community starts to show levels of desperation, then there's something about reaching for what looks like almost a magical get out of jail free card or a quick fix that could be, you know, incredibly enticing to political actors.
How do you think a quick fix would manifest, you know, especially in this climate engineering space?
Yeah, if the world starts to seriously consider something like stratospheric aerosol injection, the only sensible way, and anybody who's doing work in the space will tell you this, the only sensible way to think about something like stratospheric aerosol injection is as a very small piece of a broad portfolio of response options to climate change. All you're doing with stratospheric aerosol injection or other solar radiation management technologies is you're suppressing warming. You're doing nothing about the underlying problem, which is we have an energy economy and we have patterns of land use and various other ways that we organize our society that generate greenhouse gases and put them in the atmosphere where they don't belong. That's the problem that needs to be fixed. Part of that fix would be maybe carbon dioxide removal technologies, which draw some of those greenhouse gases down over time. But the biggest challenge is the sort of social and political transformation that's needed so that long term, human beings and the way that we live are compatible with ecological realities. That's the old sustainability challenge, and it's as present here as it's ever been. So solar radiation management is not a fix. There's no way to talk about it as a fix that makes any sense. And yet, one could imagine politicians and other actors trying to sell it as a fix. That is, we don't have to change anything about the way that we live because we now have this magical sulfur shield that protects us from the sun's harmful rays, or however somebody would start to spin this out, and therefore problem solved. Let's move on. That's incredibly dangerous. The other thing that you'd need to wrap around a stratospheric aerosol injection scheme or a solar radiation management system are kind of really robust and evolving and carefully constructed governance arrangements. These would have to be international governance arrangements or global governance arrangements just by the nature of these technologies, because an intervention in one part of the climate system is going to ripple out and affect other parts of the climate system. There's no way to kind of keep these nationally bounded. Now, when we already have an analog for this sort of negotiation in the international climate negotiations. Right? The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change has set up a process by which the world community comes together and talks about responses to climate change. And so one could imagine a conversation about solar radiation management, or a more robust conversation about carbon dioxide removal under that forum that gave us the Paris Agreement. But unlike other climate responses that require really coordinated effort, some of the solar radiation management schemes could actually be done by just one or a handful of countries acting alone or in, you know, in loose coordination. You know, the United States, all by itself, has the technological capacity and has the resources available to it to start walking down the path of injecting sulfur particles into the upper atmosphere. And if the United States or India or China or Russia or some other country decided to go it alone, then this would be a really kind of difficult and challenging set of political questions. We don't yet have the governance arrangements to push back against that sort of rogue deployment of stratospheric aerosol injection, nor is it absolutely clear that we have the monitoring capacity that we need, just in terms of satellites and so forth, to fully kind of forecast, see, and appreciate whether that sort of activity is taking place.
I wanted to get back to this idea of backdraft. What should we be paying attention to in this seemingly adjacent conversation that's taking place on climate engineering?
Yeah, so this notion of backdraft is a haunting one, I've got to say. And I'll make the point that I've made to you before, that in some ways, even talking about climate engineering is an unintended consequence of the fact that we haven't been able to do enough using other climate change response measures. So in some ways, this conversation about climate engineering fits really neatly into the backdraft notion, right? Because who would have thought just a handful of years ago that we would have reached a point in human and planetary history where there's a group of people sitting around conceiving of these sorts of almost outlandish sorts of interventions in global systems, not because they're fun things to talk about, but because of desperation. Yeah, this is not like most other technological conversations, which are inherently optimistic and forward-looking and kind of wrapped around the notion of human progress. This is a defensive technological conversation. It's to say the situation is getting so bad that we have to consider something that should, by many measures, just be off the table. And when it comes to thinking about backdraft and unintended consequences within the climate engineering space, one thing to really pay attention to is that each of the different technologies has its own risk and consequences profile. So we can't talk about unintended consequences for climate engineering. We have to pass these different technologies out and really talk about them one by one. And so what we can do as we continue the conversation is just to pick out a few of the most important technologies based on what folks are talking about, and then try and analyze them using the unintended consequences lens. The other really important thing to point out is that when you start to look at unintended consequences around a particular climate engineering technology, it's really easy to say these things are really scary. But it doesn't make a lot of sense to look at these technologies alone. One has to consider the risks and potential benefits attached to these technologies, versus the sort of world that we're seeing in climate terms absent the use of these technologies. So what I mean is, you know, it's not like if you take climate engineering off the table, we're suddenly magically going to some other way fix climate change. Right? The current path that we're on is one that is leading to between 4 and 6 degrees of warming above pre-industrial averages by the end of the century. Even if all of the pledges out of the Paris Agreement materialize, we're still looking at something like 3.2 degrees of warming. Now, all of this may improve through international negotiations. Yeah, but at the same time, even that level of warming could be devastating for certain human populations and for certain biological and other Earth systems. So we're having this conversation about risk-risk trade-offs. The risks attached to walking down the climate path that we're currently on, doing all that we can with mitigation and adaptation, versus all you can do with mitigation and adaptation with the addition of potentially some climate engineering technologies.
What kind of global governance structures exist or are emerging for discussing the different possible climate engineering challenges?
So if we're going to talk about formal governance of climate engineering, then there are a number of different places to start. Now, one way to think about something like solar radiation management as a set of technological options is as a climate change response measure. That's ultimately what solar radiation management would be. And so that suggests that the obvious place to try and host a conversation and ultimately formal governance of climate engineering is under the framework set up by the Framework Convention on Climate Change that gave us the Paris Agreement. But that's not the only way to think about solar radiation management. And in fact, given the crowded climate change agenda and all of the things that the folks who negotiated the Paris Agreement now have on their plates, they probably don't want solar radiation management and its governance added to the list of things that they need to be talking about. And so another way to think about climate engineering writ large, or solar radiation management in particular, is as a complex emerging technology that's going to require, if we move in this direction, some sort of coordinated scientific research effort. And so that suggests that national governments, through their funding, scientific agencies that are attached to governments or scientific associations of various sorts, might start to self-organize and self-govern in a coordinated fashion through time, such that governance starts to bubble up from the scientific community. And there are lots of other ways to think about climate engineering as a potential augmentation or challenge to the Sustainable Development Goals, which suggests a role for other organs within the United Nations system, as a set of human rights questions and challenges. Right? There are potentially human rights implications, negative and positive, importantly, of putting sulfate aerosols in the stratosphere. Right? If you're living on a small island state and you're concerned ultimately about your state's existence, then maybe you start in time calling out for this stuff. We just don't know yet. The conversation isn't advanced enough internationally to know what people in the Global South in particular really think and feel about these sorts of options, right? Which suggests that this could be actually beneficial in human rights terms. And at the same time, there could be negative downside consequences that most impact those who are already worst off, which suggests, right, that there are human rights implications on the negative or downside as well.
In terms of risk, how should academics and policymakers evaluate the different climate engineering technologies?
So when you start looking at the risk profile of climate engineering technologies, what I tend to do is look at the risks or potential negative consequences through three different lenses. And so we might talk about the material or environmental consequences. We might talk about the political or social consequences as the second lens. And then the third lens is a little fluffier, but it's what I call the existential consequences. And what I mean by that is, what does even thinking about this type of pathway mean for our understanding of ourselves, that as human beings, and our relationship to the planet? So let's just walk through maybe an example on the carbon dioxide removal side and an example on the solar radiation management side. You know, so you take, again, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, and the reason that I come back to that is because we're going to see it start popping up more and more because it came out of the IPCC conversation. Bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, if it worked, would be a great way to bring carbon out of the atmosphere, and through time, that's what's going to need to happen to put carbon pollution back where it needs to be, not in the atmosphere, but buried under the ground. But at the scale that we're talking about it, there are massive potential implications, downside implications of moving this direction. One of the implications is you need to build an industrial infrastructure that would take the carbon from the place where it's captured and move it to the place where it needs to be stored. And some folks have suggested that you'll need something like an infrastructure as big as the current oil, natural gas, and coal infrastructure in terms of pipelines and rail lines and so forth to move all of this carbon around. You know, think about the not in my backyard type conversations that will take place around that type of industrial undertaking. You're also going to be doing something in terms of the growing of biomass on a scale that would cause massive land use conflicts, right? And so we're moving there from the environmental challenges into now the political and social challenges. Who's going to make these decisions? Who gets a seat at the table about whether the world walks down this path? I mean, how do we start to develop systems of governance that don't just mean the richest countries trying to sidestep doing other sorts of activities for climate benefit, decide to impose all of the costs on the global south because that's where the available land is, right? And that this is just another way, potentially, to impose the cost of climate change on those who are already worst off. And then the existential challenge around this, you know, what does it mean to start kind of intervening in Earth systems at this scale? How do we even start to think about that? I mean, we live in this moment of the Anthropocene, lots of people are telling us. Human beings are already kind of in charge of the planet and we're doing a bad job at it. But do we really want to kind of step into this role of trying to willfully, you know, control Earth systems at such a scale? Right? And you can run through the same sort of exercise using those lenses for, say, stratospheric aerosol injection on the other side of this equation, the solar radiation management side. The environmental consequences could be devastating if we get this wrong. Even if we get it right, there's a potential for weather disruption, there's a potential for, you know, various other downside consequences. But if this were to go wrong, then it could potentially be quite devastating. One way this could go wrong is that you've got to set up a system that would last for at least a couple of hundred years as an intervention in the climate system. And the reason that I give you that figure, this comes directly out of science, the reason that I give you that figure of a couple of hundred years is because folks like Doug McMartin, who's a scientist who works in the space, have said there's no point in trying to walk down this path of solar radiation management for just a small gain. If you're going to do this, you'd want to do it at such a scale that you're actually seeing some real measurable decrease in temperature. Now, if you're going to decrease temperature by something like half a degree, which he suggests is about the minimum that you'd want to do for this to make any sense as a research and potential deployment program, then in order to get temperatures down through pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, it's going to take at least a couple of centuries to bring us back to where we need to be before you can stop, say, putting these sulfate particles into the atmosphere. If at any stage we had to stop the stratospheric aerosol injection after it had begun, just terminate it, just turn it off, and we hadn't done anything meaningful about the underlying problem, that is greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, then you'd get a sudden spike of warming, because all of the warming potential is still there, that would be more devastating for societies and for biological systems than if you just let the warming happen gradually. Right? And so here again, you see the environmental challenges bleed into the political challenges. How do you build a system of governance that lasts across multiple centuries? How do you start to make sure that you get the right voices at the table again and have a conversation about something that has not just implications for our generation, but for many generations to come? We're locking ourselves into a path that may just be unpalatable. Right? And so it might not be the technological challenges that sink something like stratospheric aerosol injection. It may be that the political conversation is just too tough. We just can't find a way to put together a governance arrangement that is robust enough that the world community buys it and says, yeah, we can start doing this stuff.
So where do we go from here? What's the context moving forward? And what are some of the best resources to share for learning more?
So my group, the Forum for Climate Engineering Assessment, the basic case that we make is that more people need to be paying attention to this conversation. And by more people, I mean policymakers and policy influencers, and I mean the public at large. And the reason why we think this is the case is not, I've got to be clear, because we're boosters of these technological options. In fact, we're ambivalent about whether any of these technologies find their way into the world. What we want to be sure is that if the world starts walking down this path, that we get a robust conversation that's paying attention to all of the potential positive and negative consequences of the sort of conversation. Now, for policymakers, this is really starting to be sharpened domestically in the United States by the fact that the Obama legacy around climate change is being unraveled, is being undone, which means that if the United States is at some moment going to take climate change more seriously again, suddenly some of the options that were on the table have disappeared. Right? We have to act in more radical ways more quickly to make up for lost ground down the road. And so that's where climate engineering perhaps walks onto the domestic policy landscape. When it comes to the international policy conversation, now clearly in the wake of the Paris Agreement, which sets this more ambitious target of 1.5 degrees Celsius, climate engineering is now firmly on the table. And here's what I mean by that. Nobody who was arguing for that 1.5 degree target at Paris was thinking in their heads, we should start shooting sulfate particles into the atmosphere. Instead, what they were saying was, the science tells us that unless we get really ambitious and actually aggressive with how we respond to climate change, then a lot of people are going to suffer. So the small island states and various other countries drove this conversation out of a sense of existential crisis. But when you try and marry that target, that 1.5 target, with what we know about the science, go back to the IPCC assessment report, it's not clear that we can get to that 1.5 target or stay beneath that 1.5 threshold just through traditional mitigation alone. And so although negotiators didn't intend for this to be the case, now we're kind of locked into a conversation where climate engineering is on the table. And for folks at the next couple of COPs, that will mean carbon dioxide removal. But through time, as it becomes clearer that carbon dioxide removal has its own set of downside risks, and it's only acting in beneficial ways over very long time frames and is quite costly, then one can imagine that solar radiation management starts to creep into the policy conversation as well. Now, one thing that some others have said, folks like Oliver Geddon, who's based in Europe, is that there's a lot of magical thinking that's going on in the climate space at the moment. You get magical thinking on the part of the modelers when they insert a technology that doesn't exist at scale into their models and suggest that it's going to materialize in a couple of decades and somehow keep temperatures from rising too far. And then you've got magical thinking on the part of policymakers who agree to a target like 1.5 without having thought through all the implications of what they've now promised. And so one thing the policymakers need to do is just be really well schooled on what the options are on the table, even if only to dismiss them. Now, there are going to be lots of policymakers who look at, and others, who look at climate engineering and say, this is just unpalatable. We don't want to walk down that path. But if we're not going to walk down that path, then that has to sharpen the conversation about mitigation. If those technologies are off the table, then how are we going to get there? How are we going to get to these agreed targets? If these do start to come onto the table, then they can't be used as cover for inaction. And that is perhaps the biggest political challenge in this space, is that solar radiation management or magical carbon dioxide removal technologies that materialize in some decades, policymakers say, well, just over the horizon, the problem will be solved. And so therefore we can back off the sorts of activities we should be engaging in today. Policymakers have to somehow become immune to that temptation. That means being really well schooled in what these technologies are really about and understanding that the only sensible way to think about this is as part of a portfolio of response options, not being captivated or seduced by the idea that somehow solar radiation management or carbon dioxide removal is a fix, because these are not fixes.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.